ACT Radio is taped and produced at the KTEP studios at the University of Texas at El Paso. The views and opinions expressed on ACT Radio are solely those of its participants and do not necessarily reflect those of KTEP, its staff, or management.
Welcome to ACT Radio, Animal Concerns of Texas. I'm Greg Lawson.
I'm Tom Linney.
And I'm Liz Walsh.
Here on ACT, we talk about how we humans relate to other animals.
We talk about how we use them for food, clothing, and entertainment, and how there are humane alternatives to these practices.
And we discuss why a plant-based diet is the healthiest for humans and also the best thing that one can do for the environment.
So if you're concerned about your health, if you're concerned about the environment, if you're concerned about the way animals are treated, stay with us for Animal Concerns of Texas.
Coming up on today's show, we feature a conversation with John Schlimm, an award-winning author of 15 books on cooking, entertaining, activism, history, how-to, and fiction. And his latest books include The Cheesy Vegan and Grilling Vegan Style. That's a little later in the show, but first some news.
After years of sweeping the issue under the rug, the Food and Drug Administration recently admitted that chicken meat contains arsenic. Arsenic, a cancer-causing toxic chemical that's fatal in high doses, is added to chicken feed to kill parasites in chicken and promote growth. The FDA says its own research shows that the arsenic ends up in the chicken meat, where it's consumed by humans. So for the last 60 years, American consumers who eat chicken have been consuming arsenic, which builds up in the human body. Until this new study, both the FDA and the poultry industry denied that arsenic fed to chickens ended up in their meat. The story told by the industry was the arsenic was excreted in the chicken feces. But there's no scientific basis for making such a claim. It's simply what the poultry industry wanted everyone to believe. Now the evidence is so undeniable that the manufacturer of the chicken feed product known as Roxarsone has decided to pull the product off the shelves. The company which makes the Roxarsone chicken feed is a subsidiary of the chemical pharmaceutical giant Pfizer. While they are pulling this toxic feed chemical off the shelves in the United States, they continue to sell this product to a dozen other countries, and they say it won't be removed from feed products in those countries unless it is forced by regulators to do so.
In a round of good news, California Governor Jerry Brown signed a law that makes California the first state in the nation to ban the use of lead bullets in hunting. This bill mandates that bullets will now be made from copper, steel, and other far less toxic materials, and passed despite significant opposition from the National Rifle Association. Lead-based bullets, even when not targeted towards animals, poison wildlife, including endangered species like California condors. As we know by now, lead poisoning is a significant problem, which is why it's been removed from paint and gasoline. Millions of birds, from doves to condors to owls, eagles and hawks, have died from lead poisoning each year, as well as coyotes and more than 100 other species of wild animals. Shotgun pellets are particularly pervasive, as each round can contain dozens of tiny lead pellets that can be mistaken for food by birds and small animals. This law is one more way California serves as a model for the nation in humane laws. In fact, Governor Brown also signed a law to ban the trapping of bobcats in Joshua Tree National Park and other national wildlife refuges. And just last year, Governor Brown outlawed the use of hounds in hunting bears and bobcats. It's a great day to celebrate on behalf of wildlife and the animal advocates and conservationists that work so hard to protect our wild animals and wild places.
Wild Earth Guardians reports that the New Mexico State Supreme Court has ended an extended legal challenge by the New Mexico Cattle Growers Association to the state's clean water rules enacted in 2010. Despite support from thousands of New Mexicans, six cities on the Rio Grande, and a special exemption from the rules, the cattle growers took their beef all the way to the Supreme Court. The justices unanimously struck down the cattle growers' final legal move. The New Mexico Water Quality Control Commission in 2010 gave far-reaching protection to over 700 miles of the 199 perennial rivers and streams, 29 lakes, and approximately 6,000 acres of wetlands, affecting close to 1.4 million acres of land. The commission designated each water body as an outstanding water, the Clean Water Act's most protective designation. According to Wild Earth Guardians legal counsel, rather than issuing an opinion on the merits, the court said there was no issue to begin with and it was a mistake to entertain the cattle growers. In doing so, the court didn't disturb any of the existing case law on standing or intervention. The designation, which asserts states' rights, offers significant protection of clean waters and wild forests, prohibiting any degradation from activities such as livestock grazing, logging, off-road vehicles, mining, and energy development. The National Forest Wilderness areas currently not grazed by domestic livestock can be expected to remain that way with the outstanding waters designation.
Stay with us. Coming up next on ACT Radio, we feature a conversation with John Schlimm, who's the author of a number of cookbooks, including his new book, The Cheesy Vegan. That's next on ACT Radio.
Joining us now on Animal Concerns of Texas is John Schlimm. Thanks for being with us, John.
Oh, I'm so thrilled to be with you and all my friends down there in Texas.
Well, John, can we start out by having you tell our listeners a little bit about how you got into being a vegan?
Absolutely. You know, that's always an interesting question as I travel around the country. It's usually the first question I get from media or from audiences. And when you really think about that question and the answer, you know, we all know that we all have that click over in our mind when it happened, that transition to vegan or vegetarian. But the more you ponder it, you realize that that evolution probably started long before you even realize it. And for me, you know, I grew up in western Pennsylvania, and I was the son of a butcher. And growing up, my dad owned a meat processing business, which was particularly busy during deer hunting season, which here is at the beginning of December. And at ages 7, 8, 9, I tried my hand at working in his meat processing business, doing each of the jobs, whether it was skinning the deer, cutting the meat, making the sausage.
Wow.
Well, you know, when you're about nose level with the table, those jobs don't work out so well.
Ew.
Yeah, so I think that the evolution for me really started back then, even though I didn't sort of have the understanding or the words to put with you know, sort of my dislike of what I was seeing and what I was doing. And, you know, eventually I was relegated to the front desk where I wrote down the instructions of what the hunters wanted done with their meat. And I think it's kind of poetic that that was my first official paid writing gig. I think Dad paid me about $2 or $3 an hour. And now I've come full circle writing vegan cookbooks. So you see that, you know, that evolution starts long before we realize. But, you know, the clickover for me, the ultimate clickover, really came years later. I was writing cookbooks that were not vegan, but those words vegan and vegetarian started popping up on my radar, as well as factory farm. And I read Jonathan Safran Foer's Eating Animals. And on page 266, believe me, this clickover came down to one word on one page in one book. On page 266, he is writing about Thanksgiving turkeys and just the horrendous abuse that they endure during their short lifetimes. And he basically says that these animals, and really all factory farm animals, go through their lives unloved. And it was that one word, unloved. When I saw it, it sends chills up my spine now. I got a pen and I circled it. I got a highlighter and I highlighted it. And I thought, I never want to forget that word. That's my rally call.
Did you go vegetarian first and then switch over to vegan a little later?
Straight to vegan. And
wow.
You know, what was interesting is I was writing cookbooks that weren't vegan, as neither was I, but the meat portions on my plate started getting smaller and smaller, even when they were my own recipes. And, you know, it was just sort of this slow, almost subconscious type thing, but I noticed they were getting smaller and I really just wasn't into eating them. But again, when you come from a culture like I do in western Pennsylvania, when those words vegan and vegetarian were never really on your radar, you don't really know how to make that crossover. And I think a lot of your listeners probably understand what I'm saying, and a lot of other people out there in small towns probably understand it. But I'm so grateful for that unloved moment, because that was just the nudge that I needed. And you'll see that in my three vegan cookbooks, they all carry an identical dedication, which reads, "To all the animals, so you know that you have not passed this way unloved."
Oh, that's great. And it's really timely, too, with Thanksgiving coming upon us soon.
You know, cheese seems to be the last thing that vegetarians want to give up before they go vegan. It's a big stumbling block for a lot of people. And it's nice that there are finally some vegan cheeses on the market that you can buy at stores that taste fairly decent.
Yeah, you know, for me, from my very first vegan cookbook, which was The Tipsy Vegan, where I loaded vegan food with lots of alcohol, and then grilling vegan style, and now The Cheesy Vegan, I've been determined to smash through these silly and ridiculous stereotypes that vegan food is blah and tasteless and weird. You know, I think there are a lot of people out there, non-vegans and non-vegetarians, who still think that all we eat is something akin to hummus smeared on cardboard using weird ingredients that you can only find in some obscure health food store on Mars. I don't know.
And you can't even pronounce, like, quinoa, or how do you say that word?
Exactly. It uses, well, quinoa I really like. That's a word we all need to learn how to pronounce, but I agree. And agar-agar is another one of those that are out there. You know, it's so true. You see a lot of these recipes, and particularly with vegan cheeses, because, you know, in preparation to write The Cheesy Vegan, I researched a lot of vegan cheese recipes out there, as well as dairy cheese recipes. And what I found really with the vegan cheese recipes that are out there, so many of them practically require a chemistry degree to know how to make them. And again, if you can even pronounce the ingredients to begin with. And I thought, this is ridiculous. This is not going to be the case on my watch, because I want cooking to be as fun as the eating. And so my homemade vegan cheese recipes in The Cheesy Vegan can be simplified down to four words: mix, blend, set, eat.
Even I think I can do that.
Yeah. Well, you know what? I'm hearing from parents all across the country, which this just sends me over the moon, and I know they're telling me that their kids are getting in on the Cheesy Vegan action. Because these recipes are easy, kids are coming into the kitchen and helping them make them. And, of course, what kid doesn't like to, you know, do something that's ooey-gooey and then delicious at the end? So I'm just so excited about that.
How did you learn to cook?
Well, you know, luckily I have two parents who are fantastic cooks, so I really have to credit them with that, because I'm not a trained chef. You know, and I don't even pretend to be. I really come at this from the perspective of an animal activist, though, you know, there's nothing preachy or political about my cookbooks, because really I want my books to be a place that everyone, even our more carnivorous pals, can come and enjoy delicious food and, you know, maybe walk away with an understanding that they've added a little more compassion to the world by eating in this way. But, yeah, I have to give that credit to my mom and dad. And really, as far as sparking my interest in compassion, I don't know two more compassionate people than my parents, so...
I know, it's odd that you say that when your dad ran this facility that dismembered animals, but it's like a big disconnect for a lot of people, what you do for eating or your job and how you actually feel about animals. People can really partition things very well, it seems.
Yeah, and that's something that's so fascinating to me about hunters. Because, you know, of course, again, a lot of my neighbors here in Western PA, they're hunters. And they're some of the most animal-loving people I know. And I think that's just so fascinating that there is that disconnect, that they love animals so much, but they can still, on that first day of doe or buck season, go out and do what they do. And, you know, I'd love to explore that psychology a little more in the future. Maybe not in a cookbook, per se. That would require a different type of book. But I think it's fascinating. But, you know,
it would be like a Saturday Night Live spin-off cookbook or something.
but you know, what's interesting, my dad, that former butcher, a couple months ago, he came to me and he said, "John, you know those veggie burgers you're always eating?" And I said, "Yes." He's like, "Do you mind if I tried one?" You know, and I just smiled and led him to the kitchen. I'm like, you know, that is a step forward. I don't expect that he's going to go vegan or vegetarian overnight. But the fact that he took that step, I think that's a step for, you know, one small step for man, one huge leap for veganism, right?
Yeah. Well, it often starts with a small step like that. You know, people do have a lot of hang-ups about changing their diet because food is so culturally important to us. It's a, you know, it's the center of almost all of our cultural activities. And when you're trying to plan an event and you want to have it be vegan and still have people come and want to enjoy the food, it can be a challenge.
And well, it can, and that's why I think it's so important for people to understand just how mainstream and really very natural plant-based dishes are. And there, you know, when I started working on the Cheesy Vegan, there was a whole discussion as to how are we going to spell the word. And people came to me and said, well, maybe you should use a Z or a Z-E at the end. And I said, why? I'm not trying to pretend this is anything other than cheese. This is cheese. At least my recipes are cheese. They just they happen to not use dairy products. But there's no reason we have to use weird spellings. That's not what I'm about. These are cheeses. They're delicious. And non-vegans and non-vegetarians will also love these recipes.
Well, I'm hosting a party this weekend, and I need some ideas for cheesy dishes. What, out of your cookbook, which ones would you recommend for a group of definitely carnivorous people from
Well, there is a
Texas.
Really great flying buffalo dip, which you know, everyone is just absolutely loving. And that, of course, is inspired by all those buffalo dips that we see using chicken. Well, this certainly does not use chicken, but it definitely has that delicious, hot, spicy flavor. There's also a Blue Moon dip, which works really well with the Flying Buffalo dip, and that really is based on that delicious blue cheese flavor that you know, everyone seems to love. But there's an entire section at the back of the book that I think your guests will absolutely love as well. You know, I come from, you know, once a tipsy vegan, always a tipsy vegan. My family owns one of the oldest breweries in the country here in Pennsylvania. So, you know, a love of all things tipsy literally flows through my veins. And so at the back of the book, I have a comprehensive pairing chart. So I list each of the homemade cheeses, and then I give you suggested pairings for red and white wines, beer, cocktails, and other spirits that will go with those cheeses.
So, perfect. Chapter 10, I'm on it.
So you might want to you know, whip up the cheddar cheese recipe. And again, you do not need to make any excuses or explanations as to that it's vegan cheese. You just say, this is a cheddar cheese, and which it is. And, you know, pair it with a Chardonnay for those who like white wine, a Merlot for those who like red, a great classic lager for the beer lovers, and maybe a gin martini for those who like something a little fancier.
Well, that's a great idea. It's a great resource because, you know, with the explosion of craft beer and really the party setting now where everyone's trying to make everything compatible with, you know, the food and the drink, this is a nice resource.
Yeah, pairings and tastings really are the hottest new way to entertain, which is exciting because it's fun for everybody, and it's relatively easy for the host or hostess to do because you're putting out a lot of different options. So I just try to give a really great guideline. And yeah, the craft and seasonal beer market is really just exploding, you know, which is to the benefit of all of us beer lovers. And in fact, I am working now on my next cookbook, which is going to be a beer themed plant based cookbook. So I'm returning to my roots.
Yeah, who tastes all these recipes, John?
Well, I certainly do not have to look very far for willing testers. I have lots of friends around that time. They all come knocking.
You know, I get the daily email or the daily emails from Kathy Freston about improving your life and health, and sure enough, she just plugged your Flying Buffalo dip.
Yes, right. So there, you can go right to her her site and get the website and she or the recipe. And she is doing so many wonderful things as well to promote good health and plant based eating, and certainly our animal friends. And so I certainly appreciate what she's doing as well.
And I like the way you set up the cookbook. First, you start with, you know, just recipes for if people want to make, you know, mozzarella or cheddar or whatever it might be. And then, you know, at the next part of the book, you turn around and take those recipes and put them into other larger dishes.
Yeah. In addition to the 24 homemade vegan cheese recipes, there are then over 100 food recipes that those cheeses can be used in. And those recipes cover everything from breakfast and brunch to soups and sandwiches, right on through to supper and dessert. And, of course, I had to dedicate entire chapters to just mac and cheese and cheesecake.
Cheesecake.
And those two practically demanded their own chapters. So I think people will find a lot of really delicious foods. You know, this is a book I want people to have on their counter every day and be able to use every day if they want. And certainly if people don't want to make their own vegan cheese, even though mine are really easy to make, literally a few hours, you know, you whip them up and then a few hours they need to just set. If they don't want to do that, I do have a store-bought vegan cheese guide at the end, which lists a lot of the vegan brands of cheese that are popping up in stores, because realistically I know some people will just go right to that option, and that's fine as well.
You know, I know there's a few dishes that I think will stand out here in the Southwest. There was a chorizo pepper onion stew and a amazo queso dip.
Yes.
Oh my God, those look phenomenal.
I want to try the wine cheese.
Yes, yum, yum, yum. And then you pair it with even more wine.
Yeah, and you're tipsy.
Yeah, and you know, I in the speeches I give across the country, I don't even do cooking demos anymore. Because I love to just get up there and talk with audiences, of course, about our mutual love of delicious foods, but I get to talk about my passion for animals and how all of us working together really is making a difference in the lives of these animals out there. And, you know, one of the points I make is, in addition to the fact that I want to put delicious dishes out there in my cookbooks, and that's sort of a given, or the dishes wouldn't be in my cookbooks, really the main reason I write my cookbooks is so that on some level those animals who are out there in those horrific cages and on those horrific slaughter floors in those factory farms will know that I and all of us are right there with them, our arms wrapped around them, and we're whispering in their ears, "You are not alone. I love you." And that is really the core of why I do what I do with these books, and that's why I call them tasty activism.
It's a great way to reach out to people, and there's no better way to reach people than by offering them something delicious to eat and then asking them to think about how their choices in the foods that they choose impact animals and the environment and their own health. I'm not saying that the cheesy vegan recipes are probably super healthy ones in terms of fat content. I don't know if vegan cheese is like all other cheese, has a lot of fat, but at least you're not harming the environment and like you said, saving so many animals.
Yeah, absolutely. And actually, the cheeses and the dishes in here are healthier than you would probably think, but I'm quick just because they're using very wholesome, natural ingredients,
mm-hmm.
and they're not processed. But I'm quick to remind people, I'm not writing health books here.
Yeah.
Right, yeah.
You know, maybe someday I will, and that'll be a different story with those. You know, these are meant to be enjoyed. These are treats. And I hope people will get to use them, you know, every day or at least weekly.
You mean I can't eat the mac and cheese chapter night after night?
Maybe once a week.
You can try.
Once a week.
Your cookbooks, John, are described as small town friendly. What do they mean by that?
Well, you know, I come from a small town, as we've discussed. And when you're in a small town, obviously resources in terms of your grocery stores are a little bit limited. And so I write my cookbook so that the ingredients I use are easy enough for my friends and neighbors in St. Mary's, Pennsylvania, as well as all the other small towns across the country. They're easy enough to find that they can go to our grocery stores and occasionally the liquor store, maybe even more than occasionally the liquor store. But they can go and they can find just about all the ingredients they need. And if there is something like, say, vegan mayonnaise, which we don't have in our stores here, I give, you know, all of the online sources door-to-door where services where they can order those products from. Or I, in the pantry section, all of my cookbooks have a very detailed pantry section, I will give a homemade recipe for mayonnaise using regular ingredients that you can then go to your local grocery store and easily whip up. So again, I'm all about giving options and making these dishes as accessible as possible to everyone, whether you are a first-time cook or you are a top chef.
Yeah, well, that speaks especially well, I think, to us and our listeners here, which we sort of have a small town feel, even though it's a big city.
I know we have it's a huge city, but it's still we do have
vegan mayonnaise.
Yeah, we do have vegan mayonnaise, but we really just have one store that caters to a lot of vegan ingredients, and their selection has been going down, not up, unfortunately. So it's good to know that you do provide recipes for some of those key ingredients, and I'm going to get a copy of this book and send it to my niece for her birthday, because she's just recently texted me that she wants to to become vegan, but she doesn't know what she can buy.
Oh, fantastic.
She's 18, so I think she has a lot of people make that comment, though. I had another student here at UTEP ask me just yesterday, where do you buy your food? And I'm like, well, the grocery store.
At Lowe's.
Yeah. You know, a lot of people do they want to get into veganism or vegan cooking or try recipes, but they really are kind of uninformed that most vegan food is readily available at your local grocery store.
Well, and I think that there are a lot of vegan cookbooks out there that maybe aren't exactly inviting to those kind of people who are just starting out because they use all of these weird ingredients, mm-hmm. which, again, boy, the recipes sure sound fancy and they look good, but, you know, now try to make them. I really always have in the back of my mind those people who really are at the beginning of that transition as well when I'm writing my books, so that they're easy and inviting for them to enjoy. And, you know, it's really great when you go to these veg fests, which are popping up around the country, and I actually just got to MC the D.C. Veg Fest, which was such great fun. You see such a variety of people. You see kids and teenagers, but it runs the gamut right up to, you see 70-year-olds and 80-year-olds and, you know, even a few in their 90s. And I love that because I think there's always been this perception that veganism is just for sort of the granola-eating hippies, which I love granola-eating hippies. You know, I think I was one in a former life maybe, so nothing against them. But that's not the case anymore. You know, this has gone mainstream. Everyone is understanding the health benefits of this. They're starting to understand what's happening on these factory farms. You know, and even people who come to me and say, oh, I don't want to hear about the factory farms because they'll stop eating meat. If they're already saying that to me, they already know what's going on. Mm-hmm. They just haven't had that click over yet, and they will. But I love it when young people come up to me and talk about their passion for animals and their passion for adopting a plant-based lifestyle. I mean, I think they're just doing so much, and I think it's important that we support our young people.
We've been talking with John Schlimm, award-winning author of several books, including The Cheesy Vegan and Grilling Vegan Style. John, can you tell our listeners where they can go to learn more about your work?
Yes, you can go to my website, which is johnschlimm.com, and it will list all of my social media outlets, so you can connect with me on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram and Pinterest and all the others from the, you know, all these things we're on. All those links are right there, and I love connecting with people. It's so great.
Great, John. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, John.
With Halloween just around the corner, it's a good time to remember that your companion animals can be scared, too. So keep them safely inside in a place protected from all the little goblins and ghouls at your door.
And if you're a zombie, remember that brains have the highest concentration of cholesterol. Coming up in November, on November the 9th, the Vegetarian Society of El Paso will have its annual Compassionate Thanksgiving Dinner at the Sunland Park Holiday Inn. Be sure and join us and find out more details at our website, vsep.org.
And if you'd like to listen to some of the past shows of ACT Radio, you can find them at ktep.org. Just click on the Listen button.
Until next time, I'm Greg Lawson.
I'm Tom Linney.
And I'm Liz Walsh. For the animals, the earth, and a healthier humanity, thanks for listening to Animal Concerns of Texas.